Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. Over the course of March, we're seeing something very interesting emerging in global energy markets. In the very beginning of the month, the cartel known as OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, got together in Vienna to kind of decide what they're going to do about the fact that Chinese demand for oil had suddenly collapsed because of the spread of the coronavirus. Now, it was broadly expected that OPEC and its partners, broadly known as OPEC Plus, including the country known as Russia, would agree to production cuts. The idea being that they would reduce the amount of oil that they were producing to kind of remain at par with the reduced global demand so that prices would remain stable. Unfortunately, things didn't really go as expected for OPEC because Russia declared that they didn't see it as being in their best interest to really continue to do what OPEC was doing and to continue cutting their production. It just didn't seem to make sense to them. So to kind of discuss the geopolitical and economic reasons behind why Russia did what it did, to examine the implications of the sudden collapse in oil prices, the reasons behind the collapse, the actors involved in the collapse, and most importantly, what India should be doing about this drop in oil prices, I have with me Aditya and Anupam. Welcome, guys. Let me just first open the floor to you, Aditya. Can you tell us a little bit about why is it that OPEC has generally tended to respond to a reduction in oil demand by reducing oil supply?
It's a simple matter of prices. OPEC has always needed to keep prices of oil within a specific band, which is mutually acceptable to all its members. OPEC currently has 13 members. And the country at the head of this is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is, some people call it the swing producer. I like to call it the thermostat of oil in a sense. When prices go too high or low, it's Saudi Arabia that really leads the adjustment. There are a bunch of reasons for this. One is simply that Saudi Arabia has so much oil. The other is that Saudi Arabian oil is very cheap to extract. Costs less than $10 to extract one barrel of oil from Saudi fields. And Saudi oil is also so-called light and sweet crude, which means that you can, it's easier to refine. And you can actually get some very, you can get oil fractions from it, which offer higher margins on the market. This has allowed Saudi Arabia to really influence global oil markets. This is something you can see going all the way back to 1973, the oil embargo after the Yom Kippur War. And the last time we saw Saudi Arabia being this sort of swing producer was in 2014. Saudi Arabia is back at it again, but this time they are letting oil prices just fall through the floor. And the reasons for this are unclear. It's open to interpretation. Saudi Arabia is an absolute monarchy. Its government doesn't necessarily discuss its strategy openly. But there are a bunch of possible reasons for this. To understand what those reasons might be, let's just go back to the beginning of the month, to this OPEC meeting in Vienna. So you had OPEC countries and the so-called OPEC plus countries, which have been cooperating with OPEC. And this group is, of course, led by Russia, the OPEC plus. And what happened is, on March 5th, in a preliminary meeting, they were due to discuss production cuts because oil demand in China had plummeted and they needed to cut production in order to maintain prices. But the Russian representative, the energy minister, Alexander Novak, simply flew back to Moscow, apparently for consultations with President Putin. The Saudis pushed OPEC to react immediately. They essentially announced a 1 million barrels per day production cut, half of the burden of which would be borne by OPEC plus countries. And when you say OPEC plus countries, you really mean Russia. Okay, so what they were doing was basically trying to force a production cut on Russia. And this basically has led to this price war with both sides refusing to blink and digging in their heels. Since that meeting, the Saudis have hiked production to over 10 million barrels per day, then 12, and now 13 million barrels per day. And oil prices have really fallen to their lowest in more than 20 years.
So Anupam, at this point, I'd like you to come in. Now, OPEC is obviously the world's most famous cartel, far more famous even than the cartel that Pablo Escobar used to run. But what I really want to ask you is, why is it that OPEC has been so successful and so stable for so long? And do you have any suspicions as to why it is that we're seeing divisions appearing in the grouping now?
I think, as you correctly mentioned, OPEC is the most famous example of cartel and its functioning. And in fact, I mean, in probably every single economic class which deals with cartel since 1973, OPEC has been the go-to example. So, and the reason for that is, of course, that it is also the most successful cartel that exists out there. And therefore, it acts as a prime example for all of this. Now, when in this particular situation, you have a scenario where obviously the global demand, there's a slump in the global demand, and then therefore the prices are going to tumble. And remember, not a lot of people actually understand this, and this might be basic for a few others, but cartels or monopolists, etc., cannot actually control the price. The price is still absolutely controlled by the market. What you can control, however, is the quantity supplied. So in order to kind of react to a fall in demand, what you would end up doing is a corresponding kind of reduction in supply. And you can see that why this could never happen in a normal competitive market, because if you think that by reducing supply, you can get away with it, there's going to be, some other producer who will say, I'm going to take advantage of it and increase supply, in fact, and he's going to take over your share of the market as well. So that's why it would never happen in a normal kind of scenario, in a perfectly competitive, or not even perfectly competitive, but even barely competitive markets. The only place where it can work is necessarily in a cartel, where you can force all of the people to think and, act in a similar fashion, and therefore you can enforce a production cut. Now, again, OPEC has been largely successful in doing this for, as we said, about 20, 30 years since the 1971-72 kind of the oil crisis. And therefore, it's been this thing. But now you suddenly have had more than just the OPEC countries, that is more than just the Middle Eastern countries who are part of this entire gang. And therefore, in classic game theory kind of world, the temptation to deviate from the group or the cartel's decisions is extremely high. Now, imagine a scenario where you've got five members and then, four members decide to cut down on production, and therefore the prices actually go up. And once the price goes up, you want to deviate and actually increase production. And therefore, you have higher quantity at a higher price. And that's the profit margin speaking. I mean, this is pure economic. This is what happens with every firm, right? And now you place this into context in a Putin world, in a world where Putin and the Saudis exist. And you've got all of this, magnified into multiple layers of, complexity with geopolitics thrown in.
It's very interesting to kind of trace out all the things that had to happen for us to end up in this state, right? The fact that Russia actually decided to cooperate and become a part of this energy cartel in itself happened only because of American sanctions that were imposed on it after its invasion of Crimea in 2014.
Yeah.
And because of the sanctions that were imposed on Russia then, global oil prices changed, which led Russia to kind of come and make a deal with OPEC because they desperately needed to be able to sell at some kind of price. And if you look at what's happened in the years since, right, every time there's been any sort of demand shock to oil prices, OPEC has responded by kind of cutting prices, by cutting supply. And the thing is that the costs of cutting supply are not equally borne by all these countries, right? Now, Aditya mentioned earlier that Saudi has like a particular kind of crude. Now, every OPEC country has different kinds of reserves. These reserves are accessible to various degrees. They're profitable to various degrees. And so each of these countries has a different kind of quote-unquote fiscal break-even price, which is the price at which you need to sell in order to balance your budget.
Right.
Now, for Russia, that price is hovering somewhere around the $40 mark. And oil prices right now are hovering somewhere around the $30 mark. Whereas for the Saudis, if I remember correctly, their fiscal break-even is actually around the $80 mark. Whereas oil prices now are, as I mentioned, around the $30 mark. So even though what's happening right now is that basically when Russia realized that OPEC once again wants to respond to this demand shock by cutting production, and once they realize that they would have to bear the cost of that, they decide that it was simply not in their interest to continue going OPEC Plus's way anymore. And another interesting thing that you mentioned was that a cartel doesn't work in a free market kind of system, right? Because other players will step in to take advantage. Now, that's been another major issue for Russia, is the fact that OPEC Plus does not have a monopoly over the world's oil supplies. We have a number of other countries that aren't a part of OPEC Plus. You have the US being the single biggest one. And of course, you have Brazil, and you have Nigeria, you have a bunch of other countries. Now, basically what has happened is that over the course of the last year, because Russia has been progressively being forced to reduce its supply by OPEC, what's happened is that oil prices have remained relatively high. And that means that it's been relatively profitable for US shale oil companies to ramp up capacity, because they can sell at high prices, right? Now, what's changed now is that since both Russia and the Saudis are competing to lower oil prices to as much as they possibly can, a lot of US shale oil companies are going to be put out of business because they have very high costs of operation. So you can see how the Russians are really using their engagement with OPEC as a geopolitical tool. Aditya, is Saudi also doing this? What do you think is Saudi's game here? You mentioned that they're the ones that want to make sure that Russia was going to bear the burden of the production cut. What really what is their game here? Why are they doing this?
It's really strange because the irony of this whole situation is that it started off as a discussion about production cuts, and it's led instead to the opposite. It's led to runaway production. So what are Saudi Arabia's motivations? Well, so one motivation, as you pointed out, is this idea that the Russians want to basically put American shale out of business and are possibly even colluding with the Saudis on this. I don't find that colluding part particularly convincing. But the other theory that people have is that that the Saudis are really looking at the long term. The Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who's effectively running the country today, has been, in a sense, trying to diversify the Saudi economy for a while now. He's been trying to move it away from oil. He's been trying to encourage education. He's doing certain types of very limited liberalization. He wants to create this futuristic city called Neom in the middle of the desert. So he has these ideas, some of which are pretty crazy, but there is clearly this push towards moving away from oil. And even when it comes to oil, the Saudis have been trying to get into the value addition game. So they're doing a lot more refining. They want to buy up refining capacity in other countries. They're setting up their own refining capacity. So they're trying to basically make more money out of this oil. One theory that grows out of this is that the Saudis are basically looking at, say, a 20 or 30 year time frame, and they expect oil to basically grow out of fashion, oil demand to fall all over the world as new forms of transportation, especially electric cars, start becoming more popular. And so the idea is that the Saudis are basically trying to make as much money as they can out of their oil before it becomes a stranded asset.
Aditya, is there no element of this as part of retaliation from Saudi towards Russia because they broke their deal? Could that be an explanation as well? I mean, if you just look at the economies of these different countries, I mean, Saudi Arabia has had fiscal surpluses since probably forever, and obviously has also got a balance of payment surplus as long as one can remember. So probably the ability of Saudi Arabia to withstand pain in some sense is far higher than what they perceive Russia's ability to withstand pain is. And because Russia kind of broke away initially from the cartel and decided not to kind of play ball, would that be an explanation as to why Saudis now is ramping up production and so on?
Actually, Anupam, I find that the most convincing explanation. The most convincing explanation, I think, is that you have a rash leader in Saudi Arabia and another leader in Russia who doesn't like to be seen to be weak, and that this is really a competition or a face-off between these two, and they don't really have an exit strategy out of this. At present, both are able to sell oil at more than what it costs for them to produce it, but that's not, of course, enough to fiscally break even. Even Russia can't replenish its national wealth fund with oil prices at this level. The Saudis have historically played this game of adjusting oil prices to wipe out competitors, to play geopolitics. Remember way back in 1990, the Saudis again did this so-called capacity cleansing. They basically increased oil production and oil prices fell drastically, and basically Saddam Hussein was not able to fiscally sustain Iraq, and that eventually was one of the reasons that led to his annexation of Kuwait. So the Saudis have been at this game for a while, And I think that's the most convincing explanation of what the Saudis are up to.
All right, thanks for that. But of course, in their little games of ego clashes or other forms of economic competition as well, it has massive implications for countries all over the world. Any country that is in the smaller countries which are in the, let's say, business of producing and distributing oil will obviously take a massive hit. And they might not have the capacity to withstand that form of reduced revenue or shortfall in revenue for as long periods as, let's say, Saudi Arabia can. So I'm sure there will be panicking now on top of course, what the COVID situation as well. So I'm sure many other countries would be facing the the hit in that aspect. But India's situation here, I think, is kind of interesting to say the least, because normally one would imagine that a reduction in oil prices is like the biggest bonanza and a Christmas gift to any government that's in power, and generally even to the people. Because, you know, once you have reduced kind of oil prices, it immediately translates into a number of kind of positive effects, which have a cascading kind of effect on the entire economy. So to begin with, obviously, drop in oil prices would mean everything begins to get cheaper, because transportation is cheaper, lots of things which require oil becomes cheaper. So, if you look at India's wholesale price index, all forms of oil-based products or things which have a high kind of component of oil has about 10% weightage in the entire index, right? So which means that, you know, a 10 percentage point kind of decrease or increase in oil prices will have as much as a 1% shift in the wholesale price index. So and that inflation rate, and that can quite be quite a big kind of number. So in that sense, you kind of realize how important oil prices have generally and traditionally have been in terms of inflation. But apart from that, of course, our import bill, which is the next biggest thing. So you'd normally have a situation where as oil prices fall, our import bill suddenly begins to look better and better. So generally, you can think of this, right? $1 increase in the price of oil generally increases India's import bill by about 10,700 crores, which is not a small number. This is on an annualized basis. So the reverse as well could be true, that, you know, $1 decrease in prices could result in savings of about 10,700 for our balance of payments. And that means that you just have that extra space to import other things, which you might not have. And therefore, it reduces the kind of burden on our balance of payments. So that's the second big aspect that the oil prices generally play. And the third, of course, is what from the government's angle. So, government generally, Indian government, Union government of India spends a lot on fuel subsidies. And this can be quite a big chunk. And then once prices change, either up or down, can have massive implications for how much you end up spending on fuel. That's the spending part of it. But there's also, of course, a revenue part of it, because as you realize that petrol and diesel in India and kerosene and so on is heavily subsidized on one end for the customers, and then, for certain set of customers, and on the other end is highly taxed. I mean, excise duty can be as high as, 100% in certain cases. And as the price of oil is higher, you get higher revenue. So that kind of offsetting thing, you'll have to look at how, generally that plays out. But in general, what we found is that as, fuel prices decrease, the government generally tends to massively, get kind of a bonanza from it. I mean, if you remember in 2014, one of the biggest things that happened to the Indian economy, just as our current prime minister was sworn in for the first time, was that oil prices fell. And therefore, that was like a magic kind of gift to the prime minister. So now, though, it's not the same, right? As you guys can imagine, with COVID 19 situation, everything is kind of changed, and irrespective of this oil price kind of decrease, because people are not really buying as many things, as complete kind of lockdown situation, none of these things seem to matter. I mean, inflation is going to get hit massively as it is on one side because of, lower demand, and it could see a slight increase because of supply chain problems. But overall, you would imagine that inflation will come down massively, right? Because there's just no demand for goods and services. And then in terms of import bill, as I was saying, irrespective of price change, I think people are not going to be going out a lot, which means people are not consuming petrol as much or diesel as much, and therefore this thing reduces as it is, right? So again, this doesn't really matter on, though normally the elasticity of petrol is quite low, that is, it's quite inelastic. Now you have a situation where because of COVID, people are just not going out, which means they're not buying petrol. So irrespective of the price decrease, you wouldn't see an increase in number of people buying petrol and diesel. So in the same thing for even the fiscal side. This time, I don't think the government can either expect a bonanza on the revenue side, nor really, I mean, the expenditure will be down as it is, again, as I said, because they're not going to give as much subsidy. So that's the way it kind of plays out in, it's going to play out in India. You know, in terms of the normal macroeconomic effect, which would have been, you know, massively beneficial for India, is not going to be the same case this time around because of COVID.
Okay. But Anupam, is there something else that India can do? Maybe build up its reserves?
Yeah. So then when you look at it, is there any advantage that we can take from this entire thing? And you kind of realize probably the only thing they can do is look at building their strategic petroleum reserves. And so as you guys know, I mean, strategic petroleum reserves is basically a rainy day, you know, storage of oil, either crude or refined, such that, you know, if there is a energy crisis of any sort, or there's some kind of this thing, then you can still protect your national interest and national security. So therefore, you know, you kind of store oil in whatever ways and forms, just so that it's there for a rainy day. So India, by the way, I think the US has been building an SPR, et cetera, since the 1972, when that oil crisis happened. They realized that they required this rainy day fund or whatever, rainy day emergency insurance plan for oil. But India, I think, got wise to it only about 2001-2, and then didn't see any form of activity on it until 2009-10. And then we finally decided, okay, fixed 3 or 4 different spots where we're going to build this thing and so on. So that's the way it went. And just so you know, I mean, there are different ways in which this SPR can operate. You can, you know, you can keep it underground in these kind of massive salt caverns, you know, underground caves where you can store oil, or you can keep it above ground in big tankers, etc. So that doesn't really matter.
Anupam, is it salt caverns?
Yeah, it's actually salt caverns. So,
how does that work?
Yeah.
Why salt?
Salt is very important because it prevents, for some reason, it prevents petrol from just evaporating. So, yeah, I didn't know this until I started, you know, actually reading about this. But yeah, these are actually high caverns with a high amount of salt content. And it's different kinds of salts, of course, not our standard table salt, but yeah, different kinds of salts. So India has been very slow going in this aspect. And of course, you know, cost constraint is one big aspect of it. We've just not had enough money to fill up these caverns and so on. So what we decided was that we're going to do it in two phases. The first phase is going to be purely owned by a government agency called ISPRL, which is the Indian Strategic Petroleum Reserves Limited. And then the second phase is going to be, you know, the second phase of these caverns is going to be on a PPP model. So, you know, one private player essentially digs it up, one private player finances it. A third private player is an oil company, which will do all of these transactions. And again, we've not seen much kind of activity on this. In the first phase, we've just had about 5 days of import cover. Second stage has not even begun, to be honest. And then, you know, the only thing that we count is refineries holding, these commercial refineries holding reserves. And these are not really reserves. Refineries just hold a large amount of petrol in crude form just so that they can, you know, as part of the commercial process, then move it on to refine it and then use it in this thing. So that's where India stands. And because, you know, we've been caught napping on this for so long, I think now is the perfect time to think about what do you do with the lower oil prices, right? And now is the time to build up on SPR. And you can do it on all these fronts. You can, for example, ask all of these oil refineries, most of which are actually publicly owned in some way or the other, to stock up on their holdings. And then you can, of course, yeah, SPRL itself should think about filling up these first 2 or 3 sites as part of this phase one. Just fill it up from that 5-day import cover to its capacity, which is 10 days import cover. And then get the phase two rolling, which is asking, let's say, ADNOC from Abu Dhabi or Saudi's Aramco, etc., to start that process where they start filling it up. And it's going to be very beneficial for them as well. I mean, literally what they're doing is they're buying oil from themselves on behalf of India and then storing it in our tankers. And then they can take care of, you know, take advantage of that price arbitrage. So they can, let's say, buy it at 30 now. And then when the price goes up to 70, they'll actually start even using it for commercial purposes. And that commercial purpose can be both within India, outside India. All of those things can be worked out. But I think the first thing is just to start filling this up at a time like this. Okay, but see, there's only one aspect of it, saying that, is there anything else you can, I mean, I just want to say that apart from this, you can also have, you know, store oil in other countries. So, but I just didn't want to speak continuously.
And Anupam, the other thing, of course, is that you can actually store this oil in other countries. All of these oil exporting countries, including Saudi Arabia, really have storage facilities all over the world. And they use this actually as their strategic reserves, you know, in the event of supply chain disruptions and so on. So all of those can be filled up. The problem right now is actually that because prices are so low, storage capacity all over the world is getting filled up. And pretty soon you're going to have tankers just waiting at harbors with no place to offload that oil. So this, in this game of chicken between the Russians and the Saudis, I'm not sure who's going to blink first. In a game of chicken, it's not just showing your resolve that's important. It's there's also the importance of knowing when to blink, when to swerve away. I'm not sure which one of these is going to Mohammed bin Salman or Putin is going to show that wisdom first. The other thing is, of course, that you might say that this is just economics and politics will trump economics. That is the fear. But even over there, I will just say that this is not cost-free for the Saudis. They are potentially alienating their own Gulf allies, especially the UAE, but also Kuwait. With, you know, they've just brought back online production in the so-called neutral zone that exists between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. So there's this massive amount of capacity, a massive amount of oil that's flowing into the market, and there's really nobody to buy it up. So at some point, these guys will probably come to some sort of agreement and let prices go up. And of course, Anupam, as you said, before those prices go up, India should do all it can to maximize its own benefit from this.
Yeah. But as of now, I think you've just kind of painted a perfectly dystopian and a nightmarish situation, which is that the fate of the world's economies around the fate of the economies around the world are determined by a game of chicken between Mohammed bin Salman and Putin, both of them who are unstable characters, and a 125 nanometer virus which is hell-bent on spreading complete havoc. God bless the world.
God bless the world indeed. And on that optimistic note, as always, thank you guys both for joining me, and thank you for listening to us.
Thanks a lot.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.